Dorothy, my name is Clint Hodges. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm glad to be here. I've been asked to hurry through this so we can get right into the next planning meeting for the next convention. I've noticed that everybody that's gotten up here to participate from the podium in these meetings has announced as having a job in his home group. I think that's absolutely wonderful. And I will also say that if you are here as an ordinary alcoholic and just want a meeting with Alcoholics Anonymous, I welcome you too. You're welcome here. We are people that ordinarily would not mix. We are people that come from all over the country for this particular conference. And there are some new people here, and I particularly welcome you. And I am glad to be here. I'd like to thank Greg and Joy for their wonderful job as hosts since we've been here, since Linda and I came in. And I've enjoyed the other speakers immensely. And I am delighted to have been included in this week's, this year's conference. If you're new, or sort of new, I would like you to know that you are closer to us in your relationship to alcohol than you might ever guess right now. And I say that because it looks so much when you're new, like as if everyone in the room has somehow or other managed and been able to quit drinking. And we're not drinking. And sometimes we use that word, quit. And I was struck many years ago by a guy named Chuck C. in California, who was quite a figure in those days during his lifetime, who said on more than one occasion, if I'd have known that was going to be my last drink, I would have had two. I tried to quit many times, and I know you have too. I tried so often and so assiduously, so with such firm resolve to quit. I, for a couple of years, I was going to cut down, and I quickly discovered that doesn't work for me. And I'm going to quit. Now I'm going to quit. And the first time I quit for 6 weeks. I told everybody I had quit forever. I told my wife. I told the chaplain at the base. I told the base psychiatrist, who turned out to be a dermatologist. But I told him anyway. I told the minister in town. I told too many people is what I did. So if you're new and you're an alcoholic and you decide to quit drinking, don't tell anybody. Leave it your little secret. It's always better that way. Because the people that can quit drinking don't come here. You know what they do? They quit. That's what they do. You know where they are today? They're with their families. They're in church. They're someplace. They don't come here. We, if you're new, we are the people that cannot quit. Cannot quit. And that is so deeply significant to me. If it was about quitting when Mark got up here to read chapter 5 and read those steps, maybe he have said, step 1, quit. And he didn't. He said, basically, step 1 says, you got to get that you are toast, is what it says. And boy, we don't want to get that. Words like powerless and unmanageable are not in our vocabulary. We don't like it. We have been power seekers all of our lives. If you're in this, the distracting fact of all of that, of wanting the power so much, is that we've known forever that we didn't have it. I knew when I was about 5 years old that I'm not big enough for this world, for this life. I'm not big enough. And I knew two more things right underneath that. I knew I should be big enough. And I knew I had to keep you from finding out that I'm not big enough. And so maybe me and the mother and the money in my mother's purse that I can steal, maybe that's enough. Maybe me and the money in the missionary jar on my grandma's dresser. Maybe me and the money that I can steal from my dad, or from the candy I can get from the store, or the, and finally maybe me after a few more years and a drink will be enough. And it seems like that's the homecoming, doesn't it? I was 16 years old and I was at a party and it was vodka. And there's something so profound about that experience, that first experience. I did not know what it would bring to me. I had no idea until that night why my dad drank. I had no idea what it would do for me and what it would do to me. And it wouldn't have changed any of it if I had known somehow. I had to drink. I had to have that piece. A guy named Scott Pecker is not an alcoholic, but an author says that for us, alcohol is cheap grace. And I get that. I get that. Because we need something. We need some power. We desperately need it. We're power seekers. There are plenty of people here in Naples that are not power seekers. They're not in this room, but they are here in town, someplace. We're power seekers. There's no question about it. That's why lack of power is such a dilemma for us. We have none. And we hate that. And we grab everywhere we can for power. And that was certainly my case. One of the great things about coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, for me and for you if you're new, is that you will get an opportunity to select someone to be your sponsor. And the ways we do that and the reasons we have for it and the incredible variety of people there are in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's astonishing that so much of the time we wind up with exactly who we're supposed to be with. I have, for more than the last time I had a drink of alcohol, my date of sobriety is August 14th, 1996. I have a little over 30, coming up 32 years in August. I used to say, God willing, I've discovered He is willing. The question is always whether I am. And a long time ago, over 30 years ago, I had an opportunity to have a sponsor. The only sponsor I've ever had. The man who spoke last night, Clancy. And I can't tell you why I asked him to be my sponsor, really, but I remember the day that it was so clear to me it ought to happen. I was in his office in those days. He worked for a company, a manufacturing company, the Bose Company or something like that. He had, he bought a lot of advertising space, and so advertising salesmen called on him. And he always had some one of us mates in his office, and I was sitting there one day. He had a photographs of his three daughters on his desk, and the salesman that was sitting there tried to curry favor with him by saying, "Oh, I see you had a pretty little girl every time." And Clancy said, "No, sometimes we didn't have anything at all." And I thought, I like that. See, well, and because you had the ability that I didn't have to make an unpopular decision and stick with it. Because he had strength, and I hadn't any strength. And I had to, first of all, to begin this journey, be willing to have someone in my life to whom I was willing to be accountable. I mean, I kind of thought of it as I'm two people. There's a winner in there and a loser in there. My loser never likes my sponsor. And his job some days is to make sure that the winner, there's some days it's close, you know. It's really close. And there's pitched battle between my winner and my loser. Especially when we're new. And a good sponsor helps the winner kick the hell out of the loser. If you allow the sponsor to have access to it. So if you may get a sponsor, it will hold you in good stead. If you move, it's surprising, isn't it, that we didn't quit. We look like we quit. And we couldn't quit, or we would never have come here. All of us tried to. And every one of us has a day from which he did not drink. That's pretty amazing. That is pretty amazing. I was thinking last night as I was sitting here watching that entertainment, the look back to the beginning of Alcoholics Anonymous, about Bill's story and how remarkable our origins are. Over 63 years ago, how remarkable it is that Bill said and did the things that we know he said and did. And that the other people were there with him, alcoholic and non-alcoholic alike. And I was, some years ago, talking to a guy that was sort of new, and he echoed my sentiment when he said, you know, Wilson had that white light experience. God, if I had that, I'd be okay. God, I'd really know. And you know what Bill said about that? He said, God comes to most men gradually, but his impact on me was sudden and profound. And I look back at my own life, and you know what? On the 14th of August, 1966, I was a drunk. On the 15th of August, 1966, I was not a drunk. And I have not been a drunk since that time. And I did not do that. I think God's impact on me was sudden and profound. It went right through everything that I was. And I didn't know that it had happened. I didn't know for 9 months, going to these meetings and being with you, that God had touched me that way. And I could not have even thought about it, and I really, when I did notice it. But it was so clear to me the following spring, the day for the first time that I was allowed to see my youngest son without any adult supervision. And he stood looking out over the Pacific Ocean. I held his hand, and I don't know why it occurred to me then, but it occurred to me that I hadn't had a drink in 9 months. And it brought tears to my eyes. And I can't tell you the last time that I wanted a drink. I can't tell you when that fight was over. I can't tell you when I let it go. But it was taken from me. I know that up until that time, my life had been just ragged. I lived in what I called a garage with three other guys over in Glendale, California. And I couldn't give you their names. Each had a little room. A couple of years ago, Linda and I went by there. She said, I want to see the garage. And they had torn a building down behind it. And we went around behind the street that was behind that. And we could see clearly that. And I said, that's it right there. She said, that's not a garage. That's a shed, is what that is. I couldn't have gotten a car in there if I'd have had a car. It was just a little series of rooms. There was a shower someplace, and you know, I'd hear it running. The rooms were 8x10, a little sticky linoleum floor, a little light coming out of the ceiling. I was left my last possession in addition to a box of sheets, and I can't tell you why I had a little box of sheets. It was a radio. And it had a clock. And it was a very special kind of a radio. Perhaps you've had one. This radio would start to play at strange hours of the night. Music. Not bad music. Continued to play even when I turned it off, even when I pulled the plug out of the wall. That radio played. That radio was an enemy some mornings at 4. Then you hunker down and wait an hour, and then you look and it's 4:07. I hated that. I hated that nasty, smelly little room, and it was my prison, and I was dying in there. And I quit. 4 or 5 times a morning, I quit drinking. And then I would go down and get another half pint, because that was all I was going to need. That was it. And I hadn't seen my family, my children, anybody. For a long time, I was selling encyclopedias door to door. And the guy that I worked for was also a Boabonson, which is how we met. He and I had done some business together. Nice enough guy. And one day he looked at me and he said, "I'm going to take you someplace." And he brought me here. He brought me here. And I didn't think I'd stay 6 weeks, maybe. That's how long I stay. I mean, you're nice people. I can't stay here. I cannot stay here. There is an echo in the Glendale Alano Club in 1966. There was an echo of my history. My inheritance includes hellfire and brimstone. My inheritance includes sitting in the back row of the Church of the Air in Billings, Montana, while people were invited down to the front to get saved. While preachers, I read the other day, they were laughing about it. Somebody described evangelistic kind of speakers as using the language of a land with no known inhabitants. And I thought, yeah, nobody lives there, man. That is, I don't know quite what they're doing or what they're saying. But the echo wasn't your language. I loved the language here. I loved it. I loved it that I would spot a guy that was talking about God, and I would like the guy. I wouldn't be put off by the guy, because I knew he was a drunk. But I didn't want that God thing, and I knew that it would not be ever my lot in life to do anything crazy like turning my will and my life over to the care of God. I don't do that. I don't do that for a very simple reason. My uncle came down to the front of the Church of the Air in Billings, Montana, one Sunday morning and got saved, and it seemed like almost at once they sent him to China to be a missionary. And it's like, stay away from the front of that church, man. That is no place to be. And I knew when I was 5 years old that it was all lost for me. I don't know when you figured it out. I don't know when you decided to live out your second and third and fourth choices in life. But I think I began a real fervent attempt at about age 5, because it was then that I realized that my mother did not love me. I was so shocked to realize that. I was just amazed. And it all came out of a misunderstanding, and it was never true. And I knew she was going to bring that little girl home from the hospital, but I had no idea she would keep it. And up until that time, my mom and I had this special thing going. Oh, I loved her. And she loved me, too. And we'd whisper and laugh, and she'd tuck me in, and prayer was okay with me, and she liked to say prayers. Now I lay me down to sleep. Okay, good, fine. That part about if I should die before I wake is a little unsettling, but you can get used to that. And then I realized that she loved it and not me. And she proved it very conclusively. I would go into a nursery and kind of encourage my sister to move out, so I could restore things to where they had been. And I'd give a little thump on the head and so on. And My ma caught me doing that one day, doing something, and she picked me up bodily and threw me out of there. And I knew before I hit the floor that she did not love me and never had, and it was all a hideous kind of a betrayal. And maybe by the time I was 7, I knew I couldn't get her back. And the war was on between me and her. And when I was 13, she started going to the hospital. My little brother was born shortly after that, and she discovered a lump. And in those days, the treatment wasn't very sophisticated by our standards today. We all moved back to Billings, where we always went. We all lived in the basement of my grandma's house, who hated to see us coming. And we wintered there in Billings in the basement of a house. My grandma grabbed my mom and took her upstairs and nursed her. And we weren't allowed to go up there. And I was okay with that in a way because, you know what a kid does with, you don't love me? I don't love you. I don't love you either. That's all I knew to do with that. And that spring I stood at the low rent part of the cemetery in Billings, Montana at my mother's grave, and I didn't cry. I stopped breathing deeply. And I knew one thing. I don't love you. I don't love you. And 2 years later at a party after a football game in high school, Bobka came along and I started breathing deeply again. And I entered a relationship with alcohol that I thought really was the power, because there had been none. Started at a party, and when the party was over, I was living in that little shed in Glendale, and it was 1966, and the party had been over for a while. And that Bob Bonson brought me here to you, and he brought me here to you having no idea what you did or how you might help me. But it was a kindness on his part, and I've called him every year on my birthday to thank him for that. And if you knew or kind of knew, and you may wonder the odd circumstances that brings you to a place like this on a Sunday morning when you're way too cool to be here. You might look back over the last few weeks or months at the odd people you've met, the odd circumstances, the things that brought you to this room today, because they were clearly beyond your power. Would you have ever brought yourself here? I don't think we do. I don't think so. We might bring ourselves back as I did. But I don't think so. I'm delivered here. And you said, welcome. Welcome. I was sober for 3 weeks and drunk for 2 and back to Alcoholics Anonymous, back to that little club in Glendale, back to nothing. The guy said, how you doing? At 10 o'clock on a Monday morning, which was my date of last drink. I said, I'm not doing so good. He said, why? I said, I got drunk and let everybody down. He said, the important question, he said, are you alcoholic? I said, yeah, I've been an alcoholic about a month now, something like that. He let that go. He said, well, if you're an alcoholic, you say you let us down because you drank? I said, yeah. I said, no. You didn't let us down. Alcoholics drink. Didn't even surprise us, he said. You want to surprise us, get a job, I think is what he told me. And he told me to stay there, and he told me to go to a meeting that night. And it had been a horrible night the night before. And I have no idea what prayer I said that night. I don't know why I was at a point where somebody said it this way, I liked it. They said, when we die the great death to everything but God, he finds no obstacle. And I was a different person, and I didn't know it, and I was different because the command and call to drink was not in me that day. And you know how I know that? Because I didn't drink. I had never once beat the call. And sometimes we sit in meetings and bemoan the fact that we had a thought about alcohol, which we inevitably will. But that's not an invitation. When I hear a guy report at a meeting that he had the day before, the night before, that morning, thought about drinking, and he didn't drink, I know that's not an obsession. Because when it's an obsession, we drink. And here he is sitting in the meeting, a little rattled maybe, a drunk dream, if you've ever had one. It'll bring you back to that time of horrible powerlessness. And I have been free of the alcohol. Somewhere along the line, I dropped my right to chemical peace of mind. And for a while, it looks like we're not going to have any peace of mind. For a while, it's not clear at all that it's going to be like that. For a while, we don't know. Some of us know the prayer we made. But not everybody. I listened with great interest to Clancy's walk down that more than 70 blocks in bad weather in Los Angeles to that probably day of his last drink, and I don't know what prayer he made. I don't know what prayer I made. But there is some point beyond which we're free of that obsession, and we later learn to do the things that keep us comfortable, that allow us to stay here, but it's not immediately apparent to us in any way. And I learned to do those things, and you will learn to do those things. So I'm not so much talking. I've worked on a lot of conventions. Everybody here has been around a while has. And that's kind of fun stuff. That's very interesting stuff. But it's different kind of things that we do in the meeting. You've got a little job bringing the tablecloth or a little job making the coffee. There's no round of applause for it. It's just that you do it because you know that when the meeting starts, you can sit comfortably in the seat knowing that you have agreed to be there. Because it's our meeting and not their meeting. And the more quickly you can experience that, the happier you will be here. Because this is where we live. This is our life. And it will become your life, too. Because it's here that a strange thing happens to us. Remember in that story that Bill tells about being in London at the beginning of World War I? He's over there as a young artillery officer. He's dining out on that American officer's uniform, and they're taking him around. And he says an interesting thing. He says, I was part of life at last. He couldn't have been 21 years old. But listen to that language. I was part of life at last. His life was like mine. So he had felt a part of life all of that time until then. And that's what we demand. That's what we need. That's what we're crying for. I want to be part of life. Part of life. And they took him to Winchester Cathedral, and for some reason, he really was touched by something in Winchester Cathedral. He says, much moved, I wandered outside. Much moved, I wandered outside. And he really was touched by something in Winchester Cathedral. He says, much moved, I wandered outside. Much moved, I wandered outside. And then his eye caught the doggerel on a tombstone that happened to be the grave of a guy with a oddly similar name of John Fetcher. Not Thatcher, but Fetcher. But he comes back, not to the doggerel later on, he comes back to being deeply moved. 14 pages into his story, he's in Towns Hospital, and he says an interesting thing about the cathedral experience. He said, its meaning was clear to me at last. For a brief moment, I had needed and wanted God and was humbly willing to have him with me. And he came. He came. And soon the sense of his presence was blotted out by the clamor of worldly things, mostly those within myself. And I'm looking at that one day.
I'm looking at the fact that I'm a seeker. And I want that power. And I'm sober. And I realize something. Bill had his cathedral. We have ours. This room, your home group, where you go to meetings, where you can sit in a group of other people and take your pack off, and somebody says something that moves you. How many times has that happened to us this weekend? Whether it was Clancy last night, or Jim, or Bob, or Bill and his wonderful elegance and eloquence. And all of us people. We've been moved. We have been touched. We have been totally unaware of ourselves for a moment. What I had needed and wanted God and was humbly willing to have him with me, and he came. He does that. And then the sense of his presence is blotted out by the clamor of worldly things. Mostly those within myself. I leave the meeting, I get on the freeway, and somebody comes into my lane, and we do know it, my lane. You hear that. And suddenly my mind, which lacks proportion and can't think straight, is up and at him. Ever vigilant for a front, for upset. Funny, isn't it? A lot of us have accumulated some anger in our upbringing. And it's not surprising. I mean, we didn't ask for this. We didn't ask for the family. We didn't ask for the sense of deep lack of fair play. We didn't ask for all of the things that seemed to us to be so hurtful. And yet we had this deep yearning for something to make sense of it all, for some spiritual peace of mind, for some emotional thing, for some power. We didn't ask for this. Are we angry? Yeah. Yeah. Oh, we covered over with a slick patina. We covered over with, hi, how are you? So you kind of stand for things to vent on. Because it seems so unfair. At some midbrain level, I'm not happy with how it's gone. And now I'm sober in Alcoholics Anonymous because the loving God has removed that terrible obsession. And what am I going to do? And I'm not sure that when you knew that language in the big book doesn't really invite you, you know? You don't consider it, really. What do you do with a guy that says things like, for a few months, the goose hung high? Even though we've honored that sentence on each end of the table up here. No, I'm kidding about that. So, we take another look. With a sponsor, with somebody who's been there. I would say there's something in here. There's a gold mine in every sentence. There is something in here that answers the deepest needs that I have. And we get a strange sense that maybe we've come home after all. And now it's just a question of what. Come to some interesting conclusions. I was talking to Clancy yesterday. I have had two occasions lately to be mad at other men in my life. One is my partner, one is my brother. And these guys offended me. And it always looks like the problem is out there. And when the problem's out there, I don't have an answer. And I'm left frustrated and angry and upset. And always sitting down with somebody else matters. And you get, have you thought about forgiving them? Well, maybe in 99 I could do that. Not yet, I'm having too much fun being mad. I have had an interesting time over my lifetime with relationships with women. When my mother made it so clear to me that she didn't love me. And she really didn't make anything clear to me. This was just something I grabbed. I decided I couldn't trust her. I decided later on, that kind of matures into, I can't trust women. And that brings just a little bit of chaos into a relationship. And one of the things that I hated most about my life is that I couldn't be in relationship with anybody. I was married twice drinking and twice sober, and I couldn't be in a relationship. I hated that. I never mentioned it. And I know you won't say anything to anybody about it. And today, oddly enough, I don't regret the past, and I don't wish to shut the door on it. But I have two things that stand as bookends in my life, and they both occurred at the same place at different times, about 40 years apart. The first one, I'm 13 years old, and I'm standing at the grave in the low-rent part of the cemetery in Billings, Montana. And the second time, 40 years have gone by, and I'm standing for the first time in all of that time, once more at the same grave in the same cemetery. And I approached it with fear both times, because I didn't know what would happen, but I knew there was something that had to happen. And it's called amends, really. It's called forgiveness. It's called healing. And it comes out of this remarkable program where we don't have any power. And we hate it that we don't have any power, because we're power seekers. Lack of power is a dilemma. And one day, if we're pushed hard enough, after we have gotten used to the fact that we're accountable to another human being, we'll have another opportunity to look inside and see if there isn't some place inside me where I can go, where God is. Isn't that amazing? The book just shocks me. Because I think God's up there and out there and all of that, and I don't want any. And as a result, even when I would pray, I was practicing the absence of God. And oh, come along, come back. Oh, skip on through here again. I mean, you did it once in 66, come on back. I knew you'd gone down to Naples to help you. I was never going to see him again. Or Fort Lauderdale, somebody's gone over there, weren't they? The idea, really, of coming to a place where I know there is in me a contact is a remarkable turning point. And Wilson takes you right to it in chapter 4. When you're ready. With yours for me. And it need not be anything. Stay here and do these things. Honor your relationship with your sponsor. Try not to hurt anybody. And be a part of this. And one day, the hounds of heaven get you. One day, you say, why not me? I've never, ever been able to rest without coming to some resolution with that urge in me from my childhood. And perhaps you like that too. And I will tell you that you need not address that today, or tomorrow, or in a year. But I also want you to remember, if you take nothing away from here, that is available to you when you turn your attention to it. And it's interesting, because the slightest move in his direction fits into play all kinds of spiritual rules, and that we only dimly spot them at the top of our game. We only do. But there's plenty of evidence. Blind faith is nothing that we're asked to accept here. There's plenty of evidence that there's love in God. And all we have to do is go back to the day beyond which we did not drink. Think of that prayer that you said, or that despair that you had. And you will never again not know, because you know you can't quit. And you know you didn't quit. And you know here it's not required that you quit, because if it were for quitters, the whole thing would be different, and it would be pointless. The idea of an inventory is about power, isn't it? Why would Wilson tell me, list the people you resent? Because they seem to me to be more powerful than I am. Even a guy on the street in Los Angeles that comes up and asks me for a buck has at that moment the power to make me feel weird. And he goes on my list. Why would he have me list my... And look at all he has to do with those resentments. Who and why? What did they do? What if somebody was visited on me that another person would have laughed off and seemed so horribly difficult to me that I resented that person forever? My brother, an identical friend of mine, we go back and visit together the same event at the same time. No one could have been more likely to see it as I did. And some of those things that just made him crazy didn't touch me. And some of the stuff that I saw is so outrageous. I'll give you an example. We used to live in this ratty little house in Denver. And once in a while, it was a terrible place. Just awful. And we'd get a ride home with somebody's folks after football practice. These are people who went to the bus to a school where the kids had some money. We lived in a little place that always embarrassed me. In an area town I hated. And somebody in the Packers or Chrysler would give us a ride. And we'd get about 6 blocks from our house. And I'd say, it's right around the corner. Let us off right here. And my brother was in the car. He said, no. Right here. And he'd let him get right in front of that rat hole. He'd say, that's it. That's it. I go, my God. I said, I don't live with you. In fact, I asked him, when he went by, and I said, didn't it ever bother you to have those people drop us off like that? You know what he said? He said, I never accepted the responsibility for the condition that place was in. You see how sick he is? He is. That son of a... These things have the capacity to just make me crazy. But they're idiosyncratic. Not everybody brings that to the event. And I think, of course, it's, well, everybody'd be mad about that. And
please turn to slide 2 for the continuation of this recording. Thank you. Slide 2, Elliot Fish will begin in a few moments.
It is to show me how I've been playing the game, where I've gone for power. Why it makes me crazy? Because somebody has broken a little rule that I've developed for how it's got to be. And they've offended me when they did that. And then I look at my fears, and then I look at my sex inventory. And we think at first that that's a lot about our secrets, and they have to come up, and we have to express them. But even more interestingly than that, it's about power. It's about all the ways in which I have tried to grab power from a circumstance which is not a legitimate source of power. It's all about power. The lack of it. And my total inability to live that way. And my endless attempt to try. And given those old ideas, given that mind that lacks proportion, given an ego that, according to Peebo in the AA Comes of Age, that the ego is responsible for the fact that I will adopt a stupid position and defend it till the bitter end. Where I get that? Taken together, those things leave me a little bit sloppy. I don't see the world the way that it is and the way most people see it. I have to get my mind out of the loop. I have to come up to step 5 and tell it all, and 6 and look at the way I've been playing it, and at 7, and would you please take this away from me? Would you please remove that lust, that control, that envy, that hatred, that greed, that fear? Could you do that for me? If you remove the obsession to drink, I'm going to ask you for something else. Please do that. And you know what? Amazing things come out of that prayer. I remember so clearly at about the point I was at that point in my, I was up in Northern California, and a woman from Reno was speaking, her name is Joyce. I never forgotten that talk. Because Joyce was talking about trying to get over her fear of height. We worked so hard on our fear. And she was going to get over her fear of height. You know what she did? She signed up for skydiving lessons. And I'm, wow, I don't think so. But she did. She told the story about doing it. And finally the day came, she's going to throw out of an airplane at 3,500 feet with a parachute on her back. And it was widely publicized. And in the drop zone is her husband and her kid. The woman she sponsored, her ex-husband was there. Just being supportive, I'm sure. And the parachute was wrong. And you see that she lived through it, but the story is ghastly because she said when she came out of that airplane, it was wrong, and she knew it was wrong, and she tumbled, and it caught, and she tumbled, and she finally hit, going a lot faster than it was supposed to be going. And she said she spent the next 18 months in a hospital learning how to urinate again. I go, wow. And we got that she's up there, but, you know, and you can now look and see, oh, yeah, that one tooth is out. And her husband left us. Her ex-husband, who was in AA, came back into her life as a friend, and 6 months go by, and they're sitting in her hospital room, and they're talking, and he finally said, let me ask you something, Joyce. What is that all about? And she said, you know, I've thought about it a lot. And was, you mean that? He said, yeah. He said, I was just trying to get over my fear of height. And he started to laugh. Look at the course of mind. And she said, what are you laughing about? And he said, all I had to do was humbly ask. And I said, oh, wow. That's amazing. If I'm willing, you mean if I'm willing, if I'm gladly ready to let it go, it will go away if I ask? Yeah, happened in 66. Give it another shot. That's a lot of power. That's a lot of elegant, right now power that we've tapped into. Ideas, emotions, and attitudes that have been the driving forces of people like us. I traded in for another set of ways to live our life. And he doesn't mull stuff over and is not mad. Isn't that good news? God is not annoyed with us. You'd think he would be. I don't think so. I don't think so. Anyway, you make the list of who you owe amends to and you get on the road. That road took me many places. Sitting down with people, it took me to Denver where my sister and her husband lived. He's black, and I always knew she married him just to annoy my father, who comes from Alabama, and she did annoy him. And I had kind of kept her out of my life and been disdainful of her, disdainful of her husband. And when I flew out of Denver, that at the end of that time was him making amends. Sorry about that. I had a completely different view. You know, they raised 6 kids. You know, they've been married more than 20 years at that time, which was a million-dollar record for our family by any standard. They raised an accountant and a teacher and a kid that teaches English to students in Tokyo. They have a retired child who earns their own way, working in a department store. 6 kids that are contributors, a cop. And I had a hero coming out of it. I went to Portland and I sat down with my brother. I went back to the East Coast and knelt at my father's grave. I found the woman that I had hurt. Oh. I thought I had taken her dignity in my distrust, in my madness, in my fear, in my grab for power. I had taken the dignity of every one of these women, and it was time to offer to restore that. And finally, I went to Billings. I didn't want to go to Billings. They had asked me the previous year to go to Billings. I don't want to go to Billings, so I said, I'm too busy. And now they ask me again, and now I'm under new management, so I go to Billings. And I wind up in that cemetery. This time I've got a letter that Clancy had told me to write to my mom. This time an Al-Anon, and if you're, I have a special place in my heart for Al-Anon. I'm glad you're here. And an Al-Anon has given me a shopping bag with a liter of water and some paper towels and some Kleenex and some flower seeds and a little pair of shears. And I knelt down and I finally found my mom's grave. 1915 and a little dash that represented a life to 1951. And I began to clean up around that gravestone, nipping around it. And I got mad at her when I knew she didn't love me. When I knew I had lost her, I took a lot of beatings for not being willing to snip around the sidewalk in front of our house when I mowed the lawn. And here I am. And as soon as I saw that, the tears started, and I thought I'd never get out of that cemetery. A guy had driven me over there and helped me find the grave, and I would think I was done. I'd get up and I'd walk over, and then I knew I had more tears to shed, and I would go, and he'd turn off the car. And after a while, I'd get up and I'd go to the car, and he'd turn it off because I'd go back there. He was not real thrilled with his assignment that day. 5 times he'll have turned that off. And I found out, because of God's grace, that my mom loves me. Always did. And I could always trust her. Always. I went down the road to find my grandma's grave. And I needed her. She was at least consistent, you know? She didn't vary for the whims of a kid. She set a standard. I flew back to Los Angeles, which Al-Anon gave me, because she said the women in Al-Anon in Billings had taken on the project, you should know this, of making sure your mom's grave always looks great. Amazing, isn't that amazing? And when the snow is off the ground and they go out there, she may send me a card or a note. So closer to my mom being at your mom's grave. And I had kind of come full circle. The other bookend. And something in me slipped away, and it was distrust. My feeling of not being loved, the things that had driven me all my life. Liz and I are here this weekend having a wonderful time. It's like sometimes it's like when I'm laughing with her, it's like laughing with my mom. When it was dead, it's sweetest. And so everybody that comes into Alcoholics Anonymous has a terrible time with these relationships. Most of us do. Most of us are terribly defended or terribly hurt or terribly guilty or terribly angry, and it doesn't work well up close. But there's a healing here. God's grace goes deep. You've always told me that God is love. You've always told me that God works through people. You need an amazing thing to come to see that God loves me through my sponsor. That you have an opportunity to love your wife. That you have a greater opportunity to live your life in such a way that God can love her through you. And that's the discovery I've made here recently in the last 2 years, Ed. I can live my life in such a way that God can love Linda through me. Because my love for her is going to be conditional. I mean, what color dress does she have to wear for my ego to calm down? And that's just the tip of that little iceberg. But it's a sweet way to go. If you're new here, it seems odd, doesn't it, to come in here and you think it's all about booze and it's about nothing other than love. The power is this amazing love. That's what I heard from every speaker here this weekend. That some power comes through us. It is not power. And when we can get okay with the fact that we don't have any power, but we can tap into power. We can be pulling over our head all the time. And it starts with being involved in the convention committee. It starts with being involved in your home group. If your home group isn't the best group in the world for you, What a commitment to have that group. That's all you have to do to become the best group in the world. Make a commitment to your sobriety. And we're in here to honor these people that have gone before us, that have through their own deep failure made it possible for us to live in a world where we can feel welcome and loved and comfortable. You've had a wonderful conference here this weekend, and I've enjoyed very much being a part of it, and I want to thank you. Thank you.